WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hollywood movies about rock and roll legends are more often than not disappointing. But when Gary Busey starred in the Buddy Holly story, his performance captured something of Holly's originality and energy. It was Busey's first starring role, and it earned him Academy Award and Golden Globe nominations, as well as Best Actor of the Year Award from the National Society of Film Critics. He went on to star with Robbie Robertson of The Band in Carney, and with country music star Willie Nelson in Barbarossa. Busey's most successful film commercially was Lethal Weapon, in which he played the nearly invincible villain Mr. Joshua. Busey nearly died in a motorcycle accident in 1988, but after a long and pretty miraculous recovery, he returned to making movies. Now he's starring in the new film Point Break. He plays an FBI agent investigating surfers who he believes are bank robbers. Keanu Reeves plays his rookie partner, Patrick Swayze, a master surfer. The film is directed by Kathryn Bigelow, who is quoted in the press kit as saying, "The most exciting thing about casting Gary Busey is that he hasn't played somebody lovable in quite a while." Well, why not?
Well, that's just the range of the exploitation of my energy lately. I came upon a script called Lethal Weapon several years ago and decided I wanted to do action movies. And that's the only bad guy or villain I've ever played. But it was so powerful that people come up to me and say, "Gosh, you play all these bad guys." So Angelo Pappas, the character in Point Break, he is a lovable guy. And he's got such a strong sense of determination, direction, and his objective is so clear to him. He's so target-oriented, goal-oriented, that he will not be derailed, and he does it from his heart. So that's what made him lovable. Also, here's the key. When I'm in a scene and I can't quite find the frequency to come up to the speed that the scene requires, I'll say something that's non sequitur to arrange me in the emotional arena. And I know they can always cut that out and just use what they have in the script. But in this case, they left all my non sequiturs in there. So it made Angelo funny, made him lovable, made him human. And that's what was nice about Catherine. She allowed me that space.
Give me an example of what you mean.
Well, like when I'm telling Keanu Reeves, my partner, about the bank robbers, I'm saying, "These guys vanish. They really get out of here." Well, that was about all the line was. And I couldn't come up with the emotional aspect of it. So I say, "Hey, listen, these guys vanish like a virgin on prom night. They're gone." And things like that. And talking about Calvin and Hobbes in front of a bank stakeout to get myself laughing, which was completely the opposite of what an FBI undercover 22-year veteran of the FBI should be when he's undercover at a stakeout. And he's got this theory that the surfers are the bank robbers, but yet you see he seems like he doesn't care about it. But yet, in contrast, he really does care about it.
Now, let's go back to the beginning. You grew up in Texas and Oklahoma. You played football, you played rock and roll, but you also performed in musicals like South Pacific and Bye Bye Birdie. Now, what doesn't fit in this picture?
What doesn't fit in this picture?
Yeah, it seems like football and Bye Bye Birdie seem really far apart. You must have had two really different sets of friends.
No, not at all. It was just football was the thing to do in the 50s and 60s when I grew up in Oklahoma. And my dad was an All-American football player in high school and went to the University of Arkansas on an athletic scholarship. And in high school, when I grew up, there were three kind of guys. There were the social giants, the guys who were good with women and who had cars and who had the Madras shirts and who wore English leather. I didn't have that, and I didn't consider myself good looking. I had a big silver tooth and a mouthful of braces. I looked like a Corvette coming at you on Friday night. So I wasn't the social giant. The second guys, they were the hoods. They were the car bugs. They were the guys with tattoos. They made their own gang fight weapons. They wore their hair in ducktails. And they did things to women in phone booths that I didn't know quite what that meant. So I wasn't the hood. The third guy was the jock, the athlete. That's where I have this immense amount of energy that I was given at birth. So I put it into athletics. And I became a football player. Well, I love to tell stories. And I love to be funny. And I love to express my energy. So therefore, I got into plays like South Pacific, like Bye Bye Birdie. I would be playing spring football in college and then go over and study Shakespeare at night and do A Midsummer Night's Dream. So it seems like an unlikely partnership, but it worked very well for me. It works very well still today.
Did you have two completely different sets of friends, though, your jock friends and your theater friends?
Yeah, that's right. That's the way it was in college. There was the athletes and then there was the guys in the theater. And it was I went in both worlds.
Did you show completely different parts of your personality to each world?
No, I showed every part of my personality to each world, but each one had different priorities. The football player was the disciplined athlete that was not ever going to back down, that was not ever going to get defeated. And I would be knocked down three times in one play and get up and make the tackle. That's what I exhumed myself in. And in the theater, I let my emotions go the same way I let my aggression go on the football field.
How did you start acting professionally?
I studied classical theater for the 7 years, from the Greeks to Pinter, Ionesco, Samuel Beckett, William Shakespeare, Ben Jonson, Christopher Marlowe, Ibsen, Chekhov, Moliere, theater of the absurd, reality, naturalism, Bel Geddes. I studied all that stuff, built costumes, built sets, and started acting professionally when I went to California. I studied camera technique with a man named James Best, who played Roscoe P. Coltrane on The Dukes of Hazzard. He taught me how to work in front of a camera and how to mesh my personality and my energy on a movie set. So I started professionally in 1970, and everything just fell like dominoes, one led after the other. And the first movie I starred in was A Buddy Holly Story.
Now, I was thumbing through one of these bios of you in contemporary theater, film, and TV. And there was a little quote in this short bio, and it said, "I was the last actor to die in Gunsmoke." You were on the very last episode of the series?
Yeah, that was the last one they showed in March after 18 years, and they picked my show to run, myself and John Beck. And it's funny, it was the story of a bronco buster who broke the spirit of the horse, and as he was riding in the corral, the horse threw him. He got his foot caught in the stirrup, and he smashed his head against a fence post, and he died of a head injury. And this very thing happened to me years later on a motorcycle in 1988, December the 4th. But I was the last guy to die on Gunsmoke. In my death scene, I died with my eyes open and one eye crossed. And when they saw the rushes, they said, "We can't do this on TV. You can't die with your eyes open and one eye crossed." And I said, "Well, what does that mean?" "That means we got to reshoot their death scene." I said, "Okay." So I came back and reshot it. And since it was the last show, John Mantley, the producer of the show, came out and said, "Gary, we want you to have something to take home with you as a remembrance of being the last man to die on Gunsmoke." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "It's this." And he gave me the bench that sat in front of the Long Branch Saloon for 18 years.
No kidding. You have that?
I have that in my home, yeah.
Wow. I know some people who'd love to have that.
Well, don't tell them. Don't tell them a thing. Yeah, it's really nice to have.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gary Busey, and he co-stars in a new movie called Point Break. Now, the first role I saw you in was in the Buddy Holly story. You starred as Buddy Holly. It was a terrific performance. I really enjoyed the movie. And I remember when the movie came out, reading a story about how you were discovered by the casting agent.
Well, Joy Selznick I met when I did the movie Last American Hero, where Jeff Bridges and I were brothers. And Joyce got on my side and started moving me in a managerial way, although she was a casting person. The Buddy Holly, there was a movie called Not Fade Away that was cast by Joyce 3 years before the Buddy Holly story. Not Fade Away, those people didn't have the rights to use Buddy Holly's name. So we got canceled.
What part did you have in Not Fade Away?
J.I. Allison, the drummer. So I lived with J.I. Allison for 6 months, and I heard every story about Buddy Holly there was to hear from his best friend's mouth, J.I. Well, our movie got canceled. 3 years later, the guys from Philadelphia, Freddie Bauer, Eddie Cohen, and the director, Steve Rash, from Texas, came to town. They found Joyce Selznick because they knew Joyce knew where all the Buddy Hollies were. Joyce said, "There's one guy to play this part." They said, "Who?" She said, "Gary Busey." They said, "Yeah, but he's big and he's blonde and he's not right." And Joyce said, "You must see him." "But yeah, but we got to see all these other people first." "Fine." So Joyce called me and said, "Come on in and see these people." I said, "Oh, come on. You can't make a movie about Buddy Holly. This guy is so special, and they're going to do it to playback." And she said, "No, they want to find an actor to sing. It's going to be the first musical done live." I said, "What? They're going to find somebody to sing like Buddy Holly? That's stupid. They can't do that." "Well, Gary, would you please do me a favor and get in here and meet these people?" I said, "Okay." So I walked in, and I weighed 175 pounds. I was in the middle of the surfing movie, Big Wednesday. And every story they started telling me about Buddy Holly, I stopped them and said, "No, that's not the way it goes." And then I would verify the truth of it. And I said, "Guys, I'm double parked. I wish you well on your movie. I got to go." Whoop, and I was gone. The next day, they asked me to come in and sing. And I didn't have any lyrics, and they didn't have any lyrics, so I made up nonsense syllables to "It Doesn't Matter Anymore" and "Maybe Baby," and I got the job.
Now, in the Buddy Holly story, you performed real time. It wasn't dubbed after the fact. You weren't lip-syncing to Buddy Holly records.
No, not at all. In fact, we did it with 4 or 5 cameras, and everything was done in one take, and I sang all the songs in the same key he wrote them in. I didn't see any footage on Buddy Holly, but the people who knew him said, you moved just like him, you sounded just like him, you looked just like him, you had the same energy content. And there were things I said in the movie that weren't in the script that his widow came to me and said, Buddy said that. I said these little things that were, I call them non sequitur, but they happened to be connected to the real guy. And the songs were done fast and quick and without any effort. I mean, the movie was done in 6 weeks for $800,000, and that's pretty fast.
How did the success of Buddy Holly's story change your career and the kinds of roles you were offered?
Well, it absolutely was being like shot out of a cannon over the rainbow. And at that time, I didn't have a manager, and I had an agent that just put me in the next job real fast that was just, oh, my God, it was miserable for me. And I went through about 10 years of a school of experience to get back on the ground, and now I have management, and I have a publicity firm, and I have a wonderful lawyer, and I have a good business manager. So I have a team with me that helps coordinate my energy so that I can be free to perform. And it's something you can't prepare for. You can't prepare for overnight fame and massive success like that, but it's something you got to really relax with and just take a deep breath. And another thing that's come into my psyche is meditation. Meditation is a very effective form of centering myself and getting focused with my inner self so I can control my massive amount of energy. The whole key is balancing your internal energy with your environment and those around you, and that enables you to be more powerful than you think you can be.
What kind of meditation do you do?
It's called Siddha Yoga meditation.
Is it breathing or physical?
Well, it's really a very special kind of meditation. It's kind of a sincerely private situation with me right now.
That's fine. Yeah. Okay.
And it's a very delicate matter, but it is very good. It's very good for me.
When you say that your agent just put you into a role right after the Buddy Holly story, you mean they didn't shop around for the right role, but they just put you in the next offer that came along?
Right. My price bounced from $75,000 to $250,000. So they said, get it, go. And I did it, and it was very hard.
What was the movie?
It was called Fooling Around. It was with some wonderful people, Tony Randall, Cloris Leachman, Eddie Albert, Annette O'Toole. But it was just... It was just fast surface stuff, and I didn't get into the depth of it, and I didn't know how, and I was very green and very young and didn't have any force of management around me to help me persevere that storm that was coming at me.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor Gary Busey, and he starred in the Buddy Holly story, Lethal Weapon, Carney, and the new movie, Point Break. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Gary Busey is my guest. Let me ask you about your role in Lethal Weapon. And in this movie, you were the real tough-as-nails villain. I mean, in the opening scene you're in, somebody holds a cigarette lighter under your arm for a very long time just to prove how much pain you could take. I trust that's not your arm that they held the lighter to.
Well, what we did, we rubbed dry ice on my arm to take away some of the instant feeling of the fire. And that was my arm. And we had angles where we did the shot where you could take the flame away from the arm a little bit. But I did feel the flame. And that look you see on Mr. Joshua's face is clearly a look of what's happening.
This was your first big villain role. How did you get the part?
I went after it. I read the script and said, oh, boy, okay. And Tony Howard, my agent at ICM, said, they set up a meeting. And they found out they'd already cast the part. So they called back and said, no, we can't see Gary. And Tony Howard said, you set up a meeting with him. You've got to see him. That's ethical, and that's right. My attorney, Jake Bloom, went into Joel Silver and said, Joel, look, see Gary, because he's on the money for this. And they said, okay, we'll see him. But he has to read. Well, I hadn't read for a part in 12 years. That doesn't bother me. So I said, sure, yeah, that's what James Best taught me to do, cold read well. So I said, sure, I'll read. So they gave me 5 pages of a real strong scene, the scene where I torture the Gibson character. And I went in and read it. And they said, when you finished reading, the hair was up on the back of our neck. So we paid off the person we cast, and we cast you.
Oh, that's interesting. There's a fight scene at the end between you and Mel Gibson, and this is just a hand-to-hand combat kind of scene. And the fight goes on for a really long time.
Yeah.
And it would be humanly impossible for any person to take as much punishment as you're administering to each other. Did the fight ever get to seem almost funny and absurd after a certain point? You must have been shooting it a really long time.
We shot the fight five nights from 5 p.m. to 5 a.m. Mel and I trained for 6 weeks, 1.5 hours a day with four martial artists to choreograph it. Bobby Bass choreographed the fight. The martial artists choreographed the moves. Mel and I went full speed with each other at 20-second intervals, and we did it for 5 nights. And it was the most, it's one of the scariest things I've done. And one funny thing, Mel and I never hit each other, but we came within micro inches of our faces, and we were going full speed. So we're very proud of that. And it was something we were doing in November. And it's very cold in Burbank in November, especially with those raindrops hitting you. There aren't raindrops. It's water coming out of a fire hydrant. They're about 3 inches long and about a half inch wide. And they're hitting you like bullets. And Mel and I would have to lay down in our marks, and we'd just hold on to each other, shivering until action, and then we'd go full speed. And we'd hold... He had a great method of, we'd take a tablespoon of blackstrap molasses and hold it in our mouth for 2 minutes and then swallow it and then tap on our temples real fast and take 25 vitamins. That was like every 3 hours. And that kept from the middle of your chest up to the top of your head warm.
Did you catch a cold or anything afterwards?
No. No. It's amazing. I think everyone else did, but we didn't. And we were the ones sopping wet going full speed combat.
Huh. Gary Busey is my guest. I want to ask you about the motorcycle accident that you were in.
Good. I'm glad you are.
It was, what, late 87 or 88?
December 4th, 1988. I hit the concrete going 45 miles an hour without a helmet. And when I came out of the hospital, the California Motorcycle Association got me in front of the press and said, listen, go up there and say, you know, helmets are okay, but you believe in pro-choice. You believe in pro-choice, and helmets aren't necessary. You like to feel the wind in your hair and the rain in your face, and you like to see the sun and smell the nature, smell the trees. Go say that to the press. And I'm going, okay, fine. Well, I was still in recovery at that time. I wasn't quite in sync in my brain, and I was going through a form of dyslexia. And also the helmets, I didn't like them at that time. I couldn't see, I couldn't hear, couldn't feel the wind, and it was a blocking aspect. So I said no to helmets. Well, my girlfriend, Belinda Bauer, she was on my back about this. She said, what are you doing? You just almost knocked your brains out on the concrete, and here you're saying you don't believe in helmets. I'm saying I'm believing in pro-choice. I think you can wear your helmet or not wear your helmet. She said, Gary, look at all the children that are looking up to you. Look at all the people that sent you cards and mail and flowers and letters and love. And I said, yeah, I know, but finally I had a premonition. I said to myself when I was flying back from New York to L.A. with Belinda, I said, I just had a feeling. She said, what? I said, I had a feeling I got a letter. And it said, Dear Gary, Johnny loved you. He loved Lethal Weapon. He loved Buddy Holly. He loved Insignificance. He loved DC Cab. He loved everything you did. It is this, that, blah, 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 blah. And like you, Johnny didn't wear a helmet. And we're sorry to tell you Johnny's dead. And I said, my gosh, what am I doing? I don't want to get that letter. So I changed my stance. Now I'm backing the mandatory helmet law. They wear helmets when they play football. They wear helmets when they ride bicycles. They wear helmets when they steeplechase. They wear helmets when they go into construction zones. You get on a motorcycle and go 85 miles an hour down the road and you don't wear a helmet, there's only one word that equates to, and that's stupidity. So therefore, the helmet issue is very, very, very strong in my course of action these days.
Do you still ride motorcycles?
Yeah, I have my Harley Davidson.
What's the fastest you'll drive now on a motorcycle?
The fastest I'll drive?
Yeah.
Is the regulated speed.
Right.
Why go, I mean, the regulated speed in California is 55 miles an hour and 65 on some of the open roads. But still, you got to be so sharp defensively. You got to keep every rearview mirror in your eyesight when you're riding in traffic. You got to stay in the left tire lane of the tire in front of you. That's the driving wheel. That's the lane that doesn't have the oil, the sand, the water, the silt. That's the friction tire. The space between the tires is oil and the sand, and that motorcycle has no relationship with those things.
What do you remember of the accident?
Nothing. I don't remember 4 weeks of my life.
Oh, really? The 4 weeks after the accident, you don't remember? You had temporary amnesia.
Mm-hmm. No, I had temporary unconsciousness. I had complete unconsciousness. I mean, I wasn't out. I was up and moving around. They kept journals on me. I know what I did, which is pretty silly, but they kept the journals, and I can read those and see what I did. I can see the vision of what I did by reading the words. I had temporary amnesia from, like, January the 8th to the end of January, when I was just kind of vague and foggy on everything.
How did you get your memory back?
I don't know. It just seemed like I woke up on January the 8th, and I had a burr haircut in my pajamas, walking around and going, what's going on? What happened? Said, you're in a motorcycle wreck. Oh, yeah? Oh, really? Oh, wow. What? I had no idea what had happened to me. I don't remember. Didn't remember.
Were you aware of your memory slowly coming back? Did it suddenly come back all at once? What was that?
No, it was a slow process. It's a very slow process. They say you go through four stations in a head trauma that's severe. The first one's agitation. That's when I would throw nurses 10 feet through the air because they didn't want them touching me. The second one is denial, where you're saying, I'm fine, let me go home, I want out of here. The third one is depression, where you go, whoa, what happened? Oh, my gosh. The fourth one is acceptance. And I didn't get to acceptance until April 15th the following year, and that was Easter. That was the day of the Christian resurrection of Jesus. And I realized what it is like to come back from the dead. So I was going, wow. So that's when I started accepting what I went through, and that's when I started externally healing with a conscious mind.
Are there any permanent physical effects?
No, none that I know of. No. No, short-term memory sometimes, I work on that. And I have a photographic memory, so that came back. So everything was okay, and doctors consider me a bit of a miracle.
How did you get back into acting again? When did you think you were ready, and were you ready when you thought you were ready?
No, I wasn't. Yeah, I was ready when I thought I was ready, because I thought I was ready. And I came back into acting. The first show I did was Neon Empire, a Showtime movie about Vegas in the 30s. And then I did My Heroes Have Always Been Cowboys. And then I did Predator 2 and Point Break, and then I just finished a show with Dolly Parton. So it's been a recovery time that's been pretty efficient, pretty quick, considering the scope of my injury.
When you started to act again, did you feel that you had to prove to other people in the industry that, in fact, you were healed and, in fact, you could act again?
Yeah, and to myself as well.
Was that hard to prove?
No, I just did it. I did it to the best of my ability, but I wasn't completely there. I wasn't completely focused. I wasn't completely, didn't have all my motors running, but I was there. The engine was running, but it was a little out of tune.
Is there a direction you're particularly interested in heading now in your acting?
Yeah, romantic comedy, drama, substance, the deepest part of me being revealed so that I can give somebody a vision of how to get out of what they're into or how to come into what they want to be. Just by giving a performance that is truly from my heart and the purest level. Yeah, romantic comedy, and I very much want to do that. That's what I'm going to do, and work with directors who can take my energy and put it on another level.
Well, good. Well, I wish you the best, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
My guest has been actor Gary Busey, and you can see him in the new film Point Break, which also stars Keanu Reeves and Patrick Swayze. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.